Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see a Jew.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thank you so much for checking out this episode, making your way here. If you're not already, I do hope you hit the subscribe button. We bring out brand new interviews 3 times a week, one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So if you're a big music nerd like we are, it's a great way to keep up with all of your favorite artists, discover some new ones, and know what's happening in the music world. Of course, you can find us at any of the major podcast hotspots like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, where you can also find the video version of this interview right here, as well as Acast. I'm Kyle Meredith, and today I'm talking with the Cranberries. Got Noel and Ferg. We sat down over Zoom to talk about the 25th anniversary of No Need to Argue. Now, the album actually celebrated 25 years just last year, but the reissue finally making its way out. And they'll tell us right at the beginning about why the disruption in the timeline, which you can probably guess exactly what that is. But we do discuss the reissue. The demos and live tracks that are on it, including a song they had originally done for MTV Unplugged, but never actually recorded, that finally makes its way out on this collection right here. The two also discuss building on the first LP success, working out all of these songs on tour. We hear about the progression of their massive single Zombie, which kind of taught them to be a heavier band, as well as the lasting impact of that song. You know, that's one of the few songs that has over 1 billion views on YouTube. So we want to hear about what it means in today's society, especially to new listeners who are just discovering the band. They'll also, speaking of music videos, take us back to the one for Ridiculous Thoughts, which had a music video that they didn't like. Then they redid it, kind of Frankensteined it with some live stuff. It starred a very young Elijah Wood. We'll hear about that as well. I'll get into the guitar sound on some of the record, how they covered the Carpenters at that time for the I Wish I Was a Carpenter compilation. That also makes its way onto the deluxe edition here. They even tell us about seeing Nick Cave in the studio while they were recording it. Ending up on the soundtracks to both Clueless and Empire Records, winning an MTV award, starting a riot in Washington, D.C. A very funny and mostly forgotten CD-ROM extra that they put out in the 90s called Doors and Windows. Whatever happened to that famous sofa that appeared on their first couple records? And what we can look forward to next, an upcoming documentary, and whether or not we'll be seeing a 25th anniversary for the album To the Faithful Departed. Let's jump into this, discussing No Need to Argue. It's Kyle Meredith with the Cranberries.
Hi, Kyle.
Hey, hi.
So I guess I should ask, what was the holdup? Because we're not officially on the right timeline here, right?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a bit earlier this year, but then the whole COVID thing affected the release and all that. Because we kind of had it ready for, well, I suppose towards the end of last year, we were finishing off everything. And it was ready to go. You know, I think we were planning our own summertime this year, but the old lockdown scenario and all that. Then it was due to release in September, and now it's put back to November, I believe.
Yeah. Well, we're getting there, and that's the important thing. And it's such a fun collection to listen to. I mean, so you've got the remastered record, and I want to bring up my notes here so I'm not missing anything here, but the B-sides, Away and I Don't Need, So Cold in Ireland from the original tapes. There's some demos, some live cuts on here. And one of the live cuts, I was going to ask about this too, because it's an MTV Unplugged in New York, and but it's only one. Has there been anything of keeping you guys from releasing that whole thing, or is it just like, that's the one we like?
Well, that particular song was never on anything. We literally, I think we only ever played it that one time. We kind of wrote it a day or two before it, rehearsed it with the string section, played it, and then forgot about the song forever. So all the other tracks on there, obviously, you know, we played many, many times. So I don't really know. Ferg and I spoke about this a week or so ago about, you know, how can we never recorded it or played it again? And it just seemed to get lost somewhere along the way. So this is really, as far as we know, I think the only actual recording of it. So we figured we might as well put it on something at some time. And we did a kind of an acoustic album, was it about 6-7 years ago, Farrago thing?
Yeah.
So roughly, but that was kind of, yeah, was it? So, you know, that was kind of, I guess, a more modern version of that Unplugged thing. And we released that, and we kind of didn't really see the point of releasing the MTV one then, because we kind of did our more modern, up-to-date version of it as well. But you never know, you know, what happens with things down the road.
It's out there now, thankfully. It's a lovely song. And it fits in. I mean, of course, it fits in a time and place and a picture here as we're painting with this record, No Need to Argue, which was technically your guys' sophomore album as the Cranberries, kind mm-hmm. of, you know, with the history, mm-hmm. the way it's laid out in the band names, mm-hmm. and lead singers and all of that stuff. They say you got your whole life to write that first album. For a lot of bands, that means the second record, you're up against the wall and time. I never got the sense when I look back and I read the history of this record that it felt like that for you all. Was that the case?
No, it wasn't, because there was kind of 2 years between the albums. I know the release date of the first album was pushed back a bit, so that meant we kind of had more time to prepare the second album. And we were kind of, I suppose, on a high because the first album was doing well and we were touring a lot, but we'd work out songs at soundcheck, and, you know, everything was flowing really well. Everyone was in creative spirits, and it just kind of happened really easily. Didn't feel any pressure or anything like that. We were just, I suppose, in our early 20s, we were really young and full of energy and, you know, just enjoying being on tour, because we had, you know, toured a good bit before the success kind of kicked in, you know, and it was quite a slog. And then when we started getting successful, it was kind of, you know, a big buzz, and everyone felt like we deserved it because we'd worked so hard previously to that, you know. And we spent maybe 2 years touring the first album and then, you know, writing at sound checks and stuff, and everyone, Noel and Dolores would come in with ideas and everyone kind of just pitch in, and you know, we'd record, get the sound man to record some of the ideas we had, and then the Magic Shop sessions that are on this box set. That was in the middle of a tour. We had maybe 5 or 6 days off in New York. Stephen Street was free at the time. He came over and we did those demos. I think there was 5 songs we did. And they sounded great. So we ended up using parts of those on the actual album itself.
It's interesting, especially hearing you guys talk about how, you know, a lot of these songs were road tested, that you were able to kind of play them. When you put them in front of the crowds back then, were you still working on them? I mean, were, you know, the audience hearing those early versions of the songs that made this, were they hearing what ended up being sort of the final ideas, or was it still a lot of tweaking that went along?
It was a work in progress the whole time. There's, I heard when we were getting the stuff ready for the first album, a lot of live stuff started coming up that I hadn't heard before. And there's a really early version of Zombie. And I didn't actually realize how old Zombie was. So I heard this, it was one of our kind of earlier gigs. But the lyrics are different. Now, the Zombie part is the same, but the verses. So, you know, there would be things like that. And we'd be kind of getting the feel from each other as well, kind of bouncing like Fergie would do a push here. So, you know, the band would react to that as time went on, or, you know, might add in something. Or so we all, you know, you would kind of look at each other and go, yeah, that works, this doesn't. We had songs that we put into the set that were like a disaster. I mean, no, never again. That was a bad idea. And we just forget about them, you know, or kind of Frankenstein them up and use the verse later on for a chorus and another song and things like that. But I mean, in general, we used to love, you know, we get a new song and just put it in the set that night, even if we don't really know it properly. And some songs like that, like Zombie, would have been a perfect example. Straight away, no one really knew the song, but people just went crazy the minute you started playing this. So by the time we went in to do the album, we were probably the tightest we kind of were before or after that, I think, because we had toured so much that we were able to just go through these tracks like really quickly. And we also were in with Stephen again, and that awkwardness of getting to know a producer was gone. So it just kind of, it all clicked very quickly. And definitely that couple of years of touring made a massive difference to us. And we were more confident as well.
There was a quote you reminded me of, Tom Petty had said at one point about how bands, you know, when they were coming up and everything, like you had, like to even get in the studio, your songs had to be ready. They, you know, and so you'd practice them out on the road a lot, you know, to kind of get it there. And of course, that's not so much the case these days, but I like going back and finding that, like, that was a thing, because even once you started the tour for it, No Need to Argue, once the album was out and you did the tour, you were already road testing the songs for the next record on top of that. Like, when I look back at those set lists, like, I Just Shot John Lennon was on there and Joe was on there. I mean,
yeah,
what an interesting way to write, because you're sort of writing it in front of a live audience in that way. Or did it ever feel like that?
Yeah,
we were just excited because, you know, we'd kind of spend maybe 3 or 4 sound checks going through a new song idea. And we'd be excited about it then, because, you know, when something is new and fresh like that, you're kind of going, oh, great, can't wait to hear the reaction to this one. Like, you know, and the fact that you are playing it live, you're way more focused during a gig than you would be in a rehearsal room. You know, you're extra focused for a gig and the adrenaline is pumping and all that. So you will play it differently in front of an audience. So that really kind of helped kind of fine tune things, I think, and hone little bits. You know, you'd be, yeah, definitely more focused and more on edge and kind of aware of everything.
Hearing about how the Zombie did go back that far, though, like, of course, when you read the reviews at the time, every review back in 94 will talk about how it was a much heavier, this much heavier version of the Cranberries than the first record. It's a much darker version of the Cranberries. And I thought for the longest time, maybe that was a reaction to what was happening musically in the world post Teen Spirit or something, you know, but I don't know. I guess I don't get that sense in that way. If it kind of traces a little bit back further than that. I mean, did it feel like it to you all? Because again, that seemed to be the critics' thing, like darker, heavier. Did you all get that sense yourselves though? You know, having been the ones who wrote the songs?
Well, that song is definitely, you know, it's obviously heavier than, but probably all the songs on this album. But if anyone had come to see us live, it was night and day. I mean, when we started, we tried to do what we did in the studio live, and it did not translate at all. It was you know, we used to kind of use a lot of effects and shoot a lot of reverbs and delays, and then we'd be very dry and no distortion or anything live, and it just always sounded very empty. And then it was around the time Dolores came in with Zombie, and she goes, you know, we were kind of playing it a certain way, and she was like, oh, it's got to be heavy, it's an angry song, and suddenly, you know, Burke done heavier, I went off by the distortion pedal, and next of all, it was like, well, we can be heavy instead of melody and not be like, you know, I think we kind of thought heavy means like heavy metal kind of thing. And then you did have the kind of the grunge thing starting to come along as well. And you definitely, you soak all that kind of stuff in as well. So I think the combination of all these things just kind of lined up to suddenly, you know, people were going to the gigs going, that's a good bit different than album version. But in some places it was better even, you know, there's songs there that have kind of, I guess, you know, evolved over the years that, like, I think like a song like Ridiculous Thoughts, the album version and the way we would have played it, particularly the last 10 years, they're night and day. It's a completely different song live. It's really heavy, way longer. You know, you do all these things that you can get away with live. I think the album version suits a studio recording, but it just needed, you know, it needed to be taken to another level live.
I'll hit on that track one more time too, because Zombie, that's a song that does carry on today. Over a billion views on YouTube, as they say, yeah. That puts you in a small group of artists there. I know it's sort of a hard question to answer, but what do you think that is? Is it just that it's a catchy song? Because the flip side of this is she's talking about some very heavy politically, you know, wartime things. What does that say today? Do you find that the song still speaks to today in that way?
It seems to be, yeah. Even a younger generation has picked up on it, because it's more of a song about the way humans treat each other, you know. That's the core of it. And I think that still goes on in the world. That kind of, those atrocities still happen today, you know, and people can relate to that. And, you know, the song is catchy as well, but there's also that meaning that's there, you know. It's like, you know, what are you thinking acting this way, you know, treating people like this? And you know, I think people can still relate to that. It's very relevant.
To me, that's sort of, I mean, that's the crux of a classic song, of the greatest songs. It's, you know, you can have a song very specific, maybe like when Dylan was singing about Hattie Carroll, you know, but that it's so specific, but it still will speak, you know, to the next year and the next year and today eventually. I find a song like Zombie, for the exact same reasons for that you're saying right there, do that. But you know, I also would assume, like, as a songwriter, like you're hoping for that.
Yeah, like you don't really think of it. When you get a bit, you know, you might get a sequence together and you go, wow, that's, you can kind of tell sometimes this is a single and this is not a single, you know. And for us, I guess many of our favorite songs were ones that were album tracks that didn't become singles. But I mean, you never think, we certainly didn't think, like, you know, Zombie and Linger and Dreams, like they were just songs we had, particularly like Linger is the very first song we ever had. And I mean, we were really young, 18, 19, your kids, you don't think about what's going on next year, the mind, you know, 30 years time that people are still going to be singing it. But it is, you know, it's a great feeling, and it's what every band or, you know, every artist would hope for. You kind of have to pinch yourself sometimes that you hear it still on the radio, like played with all the other stuff that's on today. And it's just, it fits in still. And it's great. And I don't think for us it'll ever really sink in properly. It's just a nice feeling to know that we weren't the only ones that liked what we were doing. You know, that there was a lot of other people that got it as well.
It's always an interesting thing. Like musicians, maybe more than anyone else, like you do something great in your teens, as you said, and you're always going to be tied to something that you did in your teens. You're always going to be repeating something that you did. Like, I don't think anybody else has that, you know? And thank God that the songs that you guys did in your teens are just amazing songs, because because there have been other instances of that as well. So it's, you know, it's really fun. One of my favorites, and you brought it up, it is another single on here, is Ridiculous Thoughts. I went back and for the first time, I kind of sussed through the whole music video fiasco of that. That, you know, there was the original one that you guys weren't exactly happy with, so you sort of Frankensteined it with a live album. I saw the original cut for the first time during the research for this, and I gotta say, just what a beautiful video, though.
Cool video.
Yeah, I'm sure it was different in context at that point, but what was it you guys didn't like about it? Because it's such beautiful pictures that kind of go on through the entire thing.
Yeah, It works with the live bits mixed in, I think. You know, with both, it's good. I think it was Laura's maid that wasn't happy initially until we did the live bits cut in with it. And then she kind of, you know, because I think we had been playing that song in the set a lot and it sounded a lot different live and felt a lot different playing it live. Always, you know, as the song evolved over the years, it got heavier and heavier. And I think she wanted to try and capture some of that live energy in the video.
And with baby Elijah Wood there, that's
yeah, I know. Yeah, it's crazy.
I remember
my daughter was watching Lord of the Rings, and I said, "Oh my God, he's in one of our videos." And then I showed her the video, and she said, "Jesus."
That's fun. And I'll hit quickly with the other single too, because I can't be with you, you know. And it's video. What stood out with me is I thought, man, back in the 90s, there was so much angel iconography in music videos. Like, if you were going to have a music video, if you're going to have multiple videos, at some point, you're going to have a beat up angel in your video.
R.E.M. springs to mind there as well, and Nirvana.
Sure. I think a Collective Soul, like one of theirs, that, like, there was just, it was like, why? This isn't really a specific question. I'm just like, why was there so many angels in music videos in the 90s?
It was an MTV thing, I bet you. These all directors are watching each other, you know, maybe getting inspired.
Noel, I'll bring up one of the guitar moments on this record that, again, a song I've heard a million times, but I started thinking about in a different light the other night, and it's Yeats Grave. And I was thinking, what is that Led Zeppelin's No Quarter guitar sound? Like, was that the same thing?
I think it was, I got a box 12 string from the 60s. I had bought it recently around that time. And as you do with any piece of gear, we got to find a place for that in the album. And then, you know, these things are meant to be. And I was like, Mark, who was our guitar tech forever, he used to go out and find these things and come back. And I was like, get it. I think we probably tried that guitar on every song, but this is the only one I actually worked on. So that's the truth of that. Yeah.
It works. It did work. It worked. It's a cool sound. It's a cool sound for that
one. Yeah. I know it would work somewhere.
Yeah. You know, we were just mentioning cool things in the 90s, how the zeitgeist, and one of the things that makes this album is a cover. And it was the moment when the Carpenters became, it was very fashionable to like the Carpenters. For good reason, by the way. I like the Carpenters too, but you guys did. You covered Close to You. And I guess that was for the Carpenters covers compilation that kind of...
If I Was a Carpenter, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, was that something you all were swept up in, or was that something sort of genuine, like, man, we do like... Like a few years later, it would be everyone like Johnny Cash, you know? It was kind of one of those things.
Yeah. No, we all knew the Carpenters. We all knew that song because it was all over the radio when we were kids, like. And then the request came in. Someone from the record company or management or something said... there's a Carpenters tribute album. They'd like you to play in it. And then we said, well, is Close to You available? You know, we didn't think it would be. And it was like, yeah. I said, oh, okay, we'll do it then. Great. Because that was kind of really the only song we knew, I think, at the time.
And
maybe
what
one or two others.
Was that just a quick session? Was that one of those things where you could kind of jump in for a day and do it?
Yeah. We did it
in London.
Townhouse. Yeah, with Stephen. I think he had a day off and we had like a day off. And it was very quick.
We did a rehearsal a day before, I think, somewhere. Because I remember Nick Cave was there.
Did we do it in Townhouse somewhere as well? No? The rehearsal?
No, I don't think so. No. It was somewhere else. It was some kind of rehearsal space. Because I remember seeing Nick Cave there and going, oh my God, here's Nick Cave.
It's always those moments. Yeah. Well, like, we love hearing about those moments. Who else is in the studio with you guys when you're doing these things?
Yeah.
You know? A friend of mine... it's going to be a weird story. Walk in on Bob Seger in the bathroom once, accidentally not knowing he was in. Anyway, that's your normal.
Yeah.
Let's bring it up. As far as pop culture goes, too, another one of the B-sides away that's on this compilation that would make it into Clueless. And again, around that time, you know, it was a different song. It was Liar from the earlier sessions that was on Empire Records. But this was, I mean, did you guys kind of feel like you were in a peak pop culture moment as a band at this time too? I mean, because you're looking, Empire wasn't a big movie then, but it has became a big movie, but Clueless was enormous.
Yeah. You don't, again, it's, you're living in the middle of it, so you don't really, you know, you kind of get these kind of things come in. Can we use your song and this and that and everything? And we were like, yeah, sure. You know, and kind of, I guess in many ways, look, that's always been the case. You don't, these are kind of things you realize afterwards, like many, many years afterwards. Like I've seen my kids watching Clueless and, you know, that kind of thing now. And you think that's just insane. That's something that, you know, would have been our generation. So it's cool that we get to be part of that whole kind of 90s pop culture. And but we definitely didn't realize it at the time. We were just having too much fun, I think, kind of enjoying the whole ride of it, because I think we were more surprised than anybody at how big the band had become.
And I know you don't always get the moments to celebrate, because they do, they sort of just come in these small moments, but occasionally I would think, like, you would go on that year to win the Song of the Year awards, right, at the MTV awards. Like, is that one of those moments where you get to go, okay, we can take this in?
Yeah. I don't know, really. It's just, the award ceremonies are funny things, like, you know, they're just a bit of fun, you know, a kind of a night to relax and have a few drinks and just enjoy yourself and celeb spot, you know. We were kind of going, oh, look, there's George Michael, or, you know, met the guys from U2 that night. That was our first time meeting them, I think, and they were really nice.
I think that's one of the things we would have assumed would have already happened by then. Like, yeah, of course, Cranberries met U2 by that point.
Everyone thinks that because we're Irish. Is that right? You live down the street, don't you, from Bono?
they tour more than we did, like, at the time, so we'd never seen them. They were always on the road.
Like in Louisville, if you live in Louisville, you've probably met My Morning Jackets and White Reaper and Houndmouth. You know, they're all around.
That kind of thing, yeah.
Monty
yeah.
Prince Billy's at the grocery store. He really is. He's over there. It is one of those things. I wanted to ask about one of the live shows really quickly too, because it's also became a bit infamous, and that's at Washington, D.C. This would be the moment that the Cranberries started a riot. Fair to say?
Crazy. But we didn't start it. The crowd started it.
Yeah.
We were actually playing Linger, I
think. Innocent.
But they all start pushing through, and we're like, Jesus, what's going on here? Calm down, people, calm down. Then our crew guys kind of came on the stage and said, lads, you got to go.
Yeah.
So we just jumped in the van. We're bemused by the whole thing. We're kind of looking out the windows going, what's going on with these people?
So,
you know, I don't know.
So you weren't on the grounds when it really, like, really went bad? Were you guys already gone by that point?
Yeah, I think so. It was just starting to, and you know, when you kind of get that kind of bad feeling in the air that something's not right here. And I think they didn't expect as many people to show up, and they didn't have enough security, and people just started moving forward. But we were kind of whipped out of there pretty quickly. And we were more worried then about, where's our gear? Is it gone? Has it been taken? But yeah, that was kind of definitely one of the more bizarre moments of the 90s, I think.
It just goes to show that passion that people really do have for the Cranberries, I think. And and also just wanting, you know, people that want to act crazy. There's an excuse, I guess, if you want one. The forgotten moment of this record, I do believe, and it's not, I don't think it is. It's not a part of this this reissue, but I've seen it recently, as I remembered it, is the Doors and Windows PC exclusive. wait, no, you've got to look on your face. I've got to ask about that.
You had to go there. No, that was strange. The money. I mean, that was just, I had forgotten completely about that until this, they were sending us stuff to kind of look at and go through. And I just, we would never have made it as actors anyway, because it's so bad.
There was a lot of blue screen stuff. So we were, there was a guy there saying, okay, reach up and grab this. There would be a door there and this kind of stuff. And, you know, turn around and hand this to Noel. And so we're kind of on a stage with nothing, trying to imagine this big world around us. It was bizarre.
That was a really funny moment, a fun moment, I think, especially now to look back on, because so many artists, you were doing that. PCs and computer culture were, you know, such a new thing, and everybody was trying to figure out how to work that in, you know, to the music world.
Yeah.
And so you'd have all of these artists, yourself included, who would put, you know, CD extras, you know, the enhanced CD-ROM version of whatever to go along with it. And I got to tell you, almost none of them aged well, like almost nothing.
Okay, it's not just us then.
It's not just you guys. But if anybody's watching, I do look it up. If you don't know what we're talking about, Doors and Windows, look it up. It's a funny one. This has got to be a question you guys have been asked a million times, and I'll close it out with this, I think, or one of these. But does the sofa still live? Was that eventually just burned? You know, what happened to it?
Some metal band had it. Well, what happened was Supergrass. You know the band Supergrass?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They had it in their first video for I Should Coco. What's the song? All Right.
All Right. Yeah.
They're on the back of a truck, so it's in that. We spotted it in that, and we're like, oh look, because it was from a props place in London somewhere. And then we used it on the first and second album, and then some metal band rented it out and ended up burning it in some video. We heard this from Callie, the guy who was the art director for he was the guy who got the couch. He was the art director for the first few albums, and he was telling us that some metal band burnt it and I think threw beer and whiskey in it and then burnt it or something mad like that.
That's a shame. That's an icon in itself. No.
There was some award we got actually once, which was like a mini couch, and where the buttonholes would be at the back of the couch were two CDs. For No Need to Argue, it was. Yeah, I still have it. I must take a photo of it.
Noel, last time I talked to you last year, you know, of course we were asking what future held for any of you all. And I will ask that again. Do you see you all playing together in any carnation, whatever it's called, it doesn't even matter, or does the future of the Cranberries exist in these reissues?
Focusing on these reissues really now, and like there is the documentary that we've been kind of working on and off with for a long time. I don't know if we spoke about this the last time, but we started. Is it 5 years ago, Ferg? We started doing interviews for what was meant to be a documentary about the band up to the first album and kind of including that era. And then, you know, Dolores passed away. We had done a kind of a few interviews for it and kind of starting to get the ball rolling. And then we put everything on pause. And then as we spoke about it over the past couple of years, it didn't make any sense to just do those first few years then, to do the full, say, 30 years of the band. So, and I think that's probably the next big thing that we're going to focus on. I think we would have been a bit further down the road with it only for COVID and everything kind of, you know, is on pause with that. But I think we're looking forward to kind of starting that, and it'll be fun to look back on the whole thing, good and bad, and kind of to get other people's point of view as well that were involved during the whole thing. So hopefully, you know, that's going to take a couple of years to do as well, particularly now that none of us know what's going on in the world. But I think that's kind of what we focus on next, because these two reissues took up a fair amount of time. And of course, we had the release of In the End as well, you know, in the past couple of years. So like there's always Cranberries related stuff kind of most weeks. There's something coming in involving us and it. And I think no matter how long we all live, that will probably be the case. You know, there's still an interest there. So I think for the future right now, that's kind of where our focus is on once. And I'm guessing even at this point, it'll be next year, you know, kind of before we can really properly start to look at that again.
That's what I wonder, like, are we going to be talking about an anniversary edition of the Faithful Departed come next year when it hits its 25th?
We don't know. They weren't actually planning on doing one for No Need to Argue, but then the first one was really successful and they kind of said, would you like to do one for No Need to Argue? So maybe they will. Who knows?
Well, they're fun. I mean, as fans, of course, we'll eat this up all the time. Especially
that's good fun for us as well, going through all the older stuff. It kind of brings back all those memories and picking out good bits. And it's kind of exciting, kind of saying, you know, the fans will like this or whatever.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. I appreciate all the music that you all done. Thank you so much for, you know, 30 years of music. And to both of you, thank you so much for, you know, going down the rabbit hole with me today and talking about it all. That's great. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Ben and Kyle.
And take care to both of you. We'll see you around.
All right. Mind yourself. Take care. Bye.
Now, I alluded to it in the interview here that Noel and I caught up last year when they had just released what would become their final record In the End. So I want to include that interview here as well. So we'll do part two, Kyle Meredith with the Cranberries. Thank you for doing this. This is a big honor. I've been such a fan of you all for for the whole run.
Yeah. It's a kind of mixed emotions on it, really. Yeah.
I mean, in the end, that is the actual title of it. It is a song on the record as well, but it sums it up, coming out April 26th. This record is so good. It's one of the best things I think that the Cranberries ever done. You know, in that remarks, congratulations. I mean, I guess all the accolades or compliments that come along with this, it all sort of has that dark lean to it, right? I mean, we're saying congratulations, but it's with a tear.
Yeah, it's a weird one, because as someone said to me, we've been doing a promo tour for, I guess, a month or so now around Europe before we go to the States. And people are kind of saying, you're out promoting the end, you know, the end of you really is what you're doing in many ways, because it's just like for us right now, and the last 12 months has just been so crazy that it just feels like it's the right thing to do now, is to just kind of finish with this. We are looking at it in a kind of funny way, in that we consider ourselves really lucky that we're able to do this album, you know, that we had enough there with Dolores that we can kind of go out on a high, if you want to say it that way, because I do think the album is really strong, and I think it's a good way to finish. But like it's kind of mixed emotions, as I say, because you wonder, oh, in a year's time, are you going to be like kind of sitting here kind of going, I'd really love to play live again, I'd love to do this again or that, and it's really hard to tell. It's just been such a kind of whirlwind year, really, from the 15th of January of last year when Dolores passed away to this very day. You know, the whole thing it's almost a blur. I wonder in a month or two's time when it's all done and dusted, how I'll view this now. You know, you kind of wonder about that sometimes.
You know, a lot of people have asked you, like, oh, would you put a different singer? And you've shot that down. And I think to a certain degree, I agree with that too. But I did wonder about what you were saying there. Is like, is there that desire to want to play these songs live, like maybe even once for like one of those tribute shows where you get a bunch of vocalists or something like that? You know, it's...
Yeah, there's definitely, look, I'd be lying if I said no, I don't want to hear them live, because in many ways, the first time we played them was the last time we played them, because we played them to record them and we haven't played them since. So it's, you know, and you are constantly wondering, oh, I want to know what that would be like live, and, you know, how we would have worked it, and because you always kind of change things up a bit. And so, like, look, I'll never say never, you know, because, you know, so many bands over the years, oh, that's it. You know, we're never doing that. It's never going to happen. And then, you know, a year later,
right,
they're on a stage somewhere together. So, and you'd be ringing me up going, you said you'd never do it. So, right now, you know what it is? It's very raw and emotional still for the three of us. Even though a year and a bit has passed since Laura's passed away, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like it's only a few weeks. Mm-hmm. So, and it's hard to imagine yourself standing on a stage with somebody else in between the three of us. So I don't know if time will change that, but right now we feel that this is the kind of way to bow out of this thing.
Sure. Well, let's then jump into the actual album itself with In the End. So from what I gather, this sort of starts with the Something Else live shows. When it all comes together. Now, playing those old songs, this album, In the End, really does have a lot of that classic feel to it for the first time in a while. Does that have anything to do with it, because you all were doing the Something Else tour, concentrating on the older songs?
Well, I guess the thing I can be thankful for the tour was that we were playing the older songs, but Dolores and I had started going, it'd be great to play some new songs. You know, we were kind of playing them going, yeah, this is great and it's lovely that we've done these other versions and all that. But we hadn't kind of written together in a while. And for the Something Else album, there's three new songs on that. But there's one co-write, which was the one called The Glory is the name of it. And we really enjoyed doing that. And we kind of thought, you know, it'd be fun to kind of do some more of that, because we hadn't done anything since the last brand new album of all new tracks was back in 2012. So a lot of time had passed. So at the rehearsals for that tour, we got talking about that. Then the very, very first day of that tour, we went to Poland. We were starting there, and it was a day off when we got there. And with the kind of thought in my head that, you know, Dolores and I had been talking about writing, I spent that whole day working in my hotel room on a track. which is actually on the album. And I sent it to her later that night, said, look, I've been doing this all day. And that was really how it began. Sent her that track. She loved it. She started working on it. It's called on the album. The name of the title of the track is A Place I Know. So it kind of launched with that. Then we were on the tour and we were both tipping away kind of individually. And when Dolores kind of couldn't tour anymore because of her back problem, she went back to New York. I ended up in France and we were both, I was on my own there and Dolores was in New York on her own board. And she kind of rang me and she said, look, would you be on for writing? Let's kind of to keep this thing going. So I said, yeah, I'd love to. You know, it would give me something to do as well. And we can use the time off productively. So we didn't say anything to anyone. We just went off and started emailing each other ideas over and back for the following 6 months then. So that was June of 2017 up until December. So we'd been doing the co-writes. Dolores had been tipping away on songs on our own over in New York. So it kind of, we started to build this catalogue of songs then. And the plan was that in 2018, we would kind of go in and start recording the album that you have today, this album.
So what's so amazing about to that point is these are, you know, in that sense, demo vocals. And and when I say that, it's like, holy cow, these are demo vocals? You know, this, I mean, yeah. That just goes to show how amazing she was. I mean, those are...
Yeah, I've been saying that to people, like, you know, when I first kind of told people we were doing this, it was like, demo vocals? Like, are you serious? Thinking a demo is, you know, kind of a throwaway thing. But it's not unusual for us to use demo vocals. She was that good that, you know, the quality, if she really felt something in a song, she gave it all. And it's like not the first time she would have come in and kind of redone a vocal and gone, oh, yeah, she preferred a demo. Let's use that. And we've done that before. So it was kind of, you know, when we went through all the songs, we felt, yeah, there's enough here. She's done enough. Like, this is, you know, we can do this album. There was a few that didn't make the album that they were demos as well, but they just weren't up to scratch. You know, she would have kind of left out words or hummed a bit or just give me a bit of a chorus and not the or a bit of a verse and nothing else. And so those ones, it's a pity because they had great potential, but they're, you know, they'll never be heard. So what these 11 tracks were, the ones that were kind of more or less finished really in the demo shape. But what they needed was, you know, Mike and Ferg in particular, well, you need the rhythm, the Cranberries rhythm section to make it that whole song, you know, to make it a Cranberry song.
Now, she had just come off the Dark Project, that band, you know, which must have been invigorating in some way, as I kind of see in the interviews. And I don't know, did you notice any of the influence from that making its way onto what she was doing with you?
No, like, we had conversations about it because we did like to go off and kind of work with other people individually, you know, outside the Cranberries as the years went on. Because we found that you may not be kind of coming back to the Cranberries with kind of, I want it to go this direction now. With, you know, you wouldn't have that attitude, but you subconsciously, these things do sit in your mind and influence you. And, you know, she said to me, oh, I really like doing that. It was fun, but I want to go back to do this now, because her big thing was that she hated singing to program drums. That was, she said, there's no movement there. I don't like that. It's, you know, it's too weird. I need the more human flow of things where things speed up and slow down. As much as she used to kill us sometimes live because we would wander around in the tempos slightly more than we probably should have. But in even saying that, she, you know, that's what she enjoyed. So she definitely, I think more than anything on this album, what I've noticed and when every time she kind of called was, she kept saying, I've loads to say. I've had so much go on in my life in the last 3 or 4 years that I want to, you know, I want to get it out there. So I couldn't write quick enough to get the stuff to her for her to sing on. She had tons to say. And that's why I guess a lot of the subject matter in these songs, it's about really kind of things coming to an end and finishing. And that, you know, was really her saying about that part of her life was gone now, was behind her, and that she was moving on.
I mean, you get that from the first single. One in the title alone, I mean, All Over Now, which, as I understand, is a song that deals with domestic abuse. But obviously that meaning means something for all of us. Did it change in that same way for you?
Yeah, look, people will read a lot more into some of these songs than she ever meant to be. You know, the what she was really talking about is all these things in her life coming to an end and her moving on. But obviously, a lot of it is about when you talk about ending of things and then the ending of the band. It just people will kind of put it together in their own mind that was it. But it was really, the album was written as just another Cranberries album. Like, this is the next Cranberries album. And we had always thought, you know, there'll be another one and another one and so on. So it was never meant to be that way, but there is no way you can kind of dodge that thing now where people will, they know it's the last album, they know Dolores has passed away, so they're going to read far more into these lyrics than she would have intended. But, like, she liked that kind of thing as well. In fairness, she used to get a kick out of it. Like, she hated explaining what songs were about to people, because she'd like to people take their version of it, their interpretation.
But in that sense, it is a bit of a shame, because when you're like, she was writing about very personal things, but, you know, these are big themes that help out people in the end, you know? So to kind of be obscured a bit in that way, I mean, that part's a bit of a shame, I guess.
Yeah, it is. But it's, you know, unfortunately, it's something, you know, that we kind of have to live with for it's like, I have sat there some nights wondering what she would have thought of this album now, you know, the finished version. But that's the kind of stuff that you can drive you mad. You know, you're kind of wondering what she would have done, and would it still sound the same or whatever. But it's just one of those things you kind of just have to, you'll never know.
Well, let me look into one too deep here as something that I sort of had a mini mind-blowing moment when I put the two together, because when you go back to the very first record and the very first track, I Still Do, she says the line, "I can't see the future." And when you go to the very last song of your very last album, it's followed by "Everything you wanted was nothing that you wanted in the end." I mean, it reads like a story. The literal last words are "the end," you know, and that's... I mean, I guess that's complete coincidence as we're talking here, but now I don't know another band where you can look at a catalog where it starts at a beginning of a story and ends at one in lyrically in such an interesting way. I mean, that's the stuff of myth making right there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the whole thing has just been a kind of a series of weird kind of, you know, coincidences really in many ways, because she, like that song in the end, you know, where they're playing it on the last day, and you're kind of going, oh God, this is so weird. Like, this was our last day recording, our last day playing together as the Cranberries, you know. And we were listening to the lyrics of this song, and you're going, like, I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up, really. And it was just bizarre, kind of. And when we finished recording it that day, we kind of thought, yep, that's the title of the album right there. You know, kind of it wrote itself, as they say.
Beyond that, I'll also throw a big old compliment to "Wake Me When It's Over." I mean, it's a harder song. It, you know, it harkens back to some of those heavier songs that you do, and kind of stands out in that way on the record. Did that come from anywhere specific?
Well, that was, you know, it's a real kind of classic kind of, it's one of Dolores' songs, and it has that kind of feeling of Zombie to me. That's what it, you know, that kind of softer verse with a big anthem-y kind of chorus, you know. And as far as I know, it'll be the next single as well. It'll be the second single from the album, because it kind of, when we heard it, we thought, yeah, that's got all the elements that you need. Because the surprising thing we found is that the first single came out and everybody was going, oh, that's not at all what we expected. We thought it was going to be like this kind of morbidy, maybe an acoustic track or a piano track or something, you know, really downbeat. And everybody was just really surprised that it was like this kind of big, rocky kind of drum intro kind of thing and all this. So I think I like the idea that the next single is down that vein as well, of a big kind of rock song, because you know, it drives home the fact that this album was written just as another Cranberries album. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I mean, it's one of my favorites right now of the year on top of that, but I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Of it. And so many on here. You know, this does put it all to bed, but, you know, there is the idea, and I've heard you all talk about it a little bit, that later on in the year, No Need to Argue will celebrate its 25th, and I was wondering if there are plans for it to follow in the everybody else's footsteps in the way that, you know, the anniversary editions.
Yeah, there'll be something, but it's kind of harder. It's a bit of a hard one because with the first one, we had done so much stuff before that album came out that had never been released. It was actually, in a small way, easier to get bits because you had a lot of demo recordings and live stuff and photos no one had ever seen before. So you'd all that. Whereas when the second album came out, we had been, or, you know, we had the success of the first album and everything we were doing was released more or less straight away between radio sessions and gigs. And so it's proving a bit more difficult to find kind of unheard things or kind of rarities. Now we are working on it, but it may not have the, you know, the as kind of a large presence as the first one did, because we were really, really happy with that. It just, I thought it looked great and had tons in there that nobody had ever heard. And a lot of stuff we'd even forgotten about. So there'll be something, but I don't think it'll be on the same size as the first one.
Now, I know that same year hopefully it's okay that I spent a second in 1994 here, because, you know, here we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, which you all played the 25th anniversary of Woodstock that year. And, you know, hearing some of that, I went back and I think it was Dreams that got released on the actual soundtrack. But I don't, if you can go back there for a second, like, what do you remember about that gig? Because that was it different than other shows, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Like, it's funny because it's still to this day has stood out for each one of us. It was just, we had never played to a crowd that size. And it was just like, when you looked out on that stage, I mean, as far as you could see into the horizon was just bodies everywhere. And they were all just going absolutely insane. And we were on early enough that day. We managed to avoid the kind of, the rain came down and it all got muddy and all messy afterwards. So we were lucky in that sense that we were long gone. But it's always been one that we remembered because of the vastness of it. We had never done anything like that. And we were still kind of, in many ways, it was still early days for us, even though we were having a lot of success. You know, you play gigs, you know, every day, but nothing like that. I can kind of remember like it was yesterday, really.
What was the was there camaraderie with the bands? Were you all able to do that in that setting?
No, it was too big, because I remember there was the backstage area was literally a helicopter right away. So that's how you got.
Wow.
You got kind of shipped from, it was a kind of a lake, right? I remember this, there was a lake and a kind of a lower, like a campsite, but it was actually, that was the backstage area. And then you got a helicopter and you went over, you landed literally behind the stage. And my brother, the bass player, Mike, he wouldn't get in the helicopter. He had a fear of it. So he ended up getting a boat, had to leave way before we did to get across the lake. But it was just, so you kind of went there, you did that, you were on, and then they kind of wanted you out of there because there was too many bands, too many people around for everybody to be hanging around the place. So it was a really quick day in that sense.
Yeah. Now, I just heard that the Green Day is actually releasing their set on Record Store Day. Do you all have the rights to that? Is that something you all could ever do, is start releasing some live shows, especially one like that?
Yeah, I'm sure we could. And because it was for this Record Store Day, we had an idea only about maybe a month ago, but we were way, way too late. So it's something we might do next year with a song from this album and one from an older album that slightly different versions that we have that we're looking at doing. So next year, I think, is the plan to try and do something a bit special.
I mean, that's good to know, because even if, you know, the album cycle is kind of closing, just knowing that there's still stuff that, you know, the fans can kind of grab onto and everything like that. So that's exciting, you know, that's in that way.
Yeah.
Noel, it was such a pleasure talking to you. This is a beautiful record. It's a fantastic record. And, you know, for how it had to happen, I love it. I really do.
Great. Thank you so much. That's great. You know, it's good to hear that, because we've lived with it for, like, it's really, I actually looked this morning for something else. It was the 16th of April last year. It was the first day of recording. So it's almost a year since we started this.
Oh, wow.
And it's a long time to live with an album. So it's great. To kind of, because you're anxious about, oh, what would people make of it and everything. So when you start to get a bit of feedback back from people, it's fantastic, and you know you've done the right thing then.
Well, I'm so glad that we have this music, that you were far enough along that we could get this music. It's
yeah,
very fortunate. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you.
All right. Take
care.
Talk
to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
And my thanks, Noel Ferg, once again. The latest reissue is No Need to Argue, and you can find the video version of this one on YouTube as well. Thanks to you for checking out this episode and this series. Before you get out, if you're not already, man, you made it this far. I really do hope you hit that subscribe button. Again, wherever you like to get your podcasts from, that includes iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, and YouTube. After that, head to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, an hour full of song premieres and music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. Again, that's WFPK.org, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news. I'm also on the social media spots, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of them at Kyle Meredith. Please do follow and like along there as well. That does it for another edition. Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
I'm Leor Phillips, host of This Must Be the Gig. We're a weekly podcast that documents everything about the world of live music. Speaking with choreographers, costume and set designers, the people who run beloved venues and festivals, and, of course, speaking with musicians about that one gig that changed their lives. Get your peek behind the curtain at consequenceofsound.net, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.